Hello and welcome to The Rest is Education. I'm David Marshall. Here with me are Ramita Anand, author, educator and founder of Elevate RA, and Isabel Rich. Isabel is an educational consultant, has done work for the Good Schools Guide and tutoring as well. She's an all-round educational expert. Isabel and Ramita, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. I really appreciate you asking me to come on.
And I can't believe you called me an expert. I feel terribly important now. I'll try and live up to the reputation.
In every way. I should also say that Ramita and I have worked together up until relatively recently, and Isabella and I have worked together as well. So we're all of sorts colleagues, all connected in some way. What we're going to start with today is talking about what does a child-centered education look like? Going back a few years, in 1989, the United Nations recognised the rights of every child in a resolution that has since become codified in 54 principles, which established childhood as entitled to special care and assistance. At the heart of this convention is recognition that every child should grow up in a family environment of happiness, love, and understanding. We'll be looking into this a little bit more shortly. First of all, I wanted to put the question, why is this an important issue to discuss? Why is it helpful to take a child-centered view of education? Ramita, what's your thoughts?
Well, I think there are probably many ways to look at this, but I think the most central argument, or one would say compelling evidence around why we want to look at things from a child-centric point of view, is you get the best outcomes from your children when you are looking at life from their perspective or their lens, and you are looking at cultivating the best version that you can of the child that you've got. And I think if we concentrate and look at the way they are viewing things, the interests that they show you, the way they play, the explanations they offer, you are allowing them to feel validated, that they feel a sense of autonomy, they feel a sense of value. And suddenly you have hooked them, in a sense, as if you'd like to use an educator's point of view, into seeking more from you. You've built a sense of trust with them because they've seen that you're interested in what they're providing you from their view. And I think the greatest outcomes, as we can probably vouch for as even parents, is allowing them to feel a sense of belonging and intrinsically feeling like they are being valued. I don't know if most teachers sometimes fall under the trap, or many teachers I've certainly worked with under the sort of worries, and it's not something that maybe we do consciously. I think it can be a very subconscious thing that we are so busy trying to think that we've got to deliver things, that we look at children as sort of passive agents when we're teaching, and we might be sharing ways that we think are our best practices to allow them to learn. However, our delivery might not be best for them. So if we take a child-centric approach to teaching, we are really hoping to increase the knowledge and increase their learning to their best ability. Does that sound like a good start?
It's interesting to hear you talk about how that shift of view, that shift of lens, you actually start to understand where the children are, what they're feeling, which might be very different from what we as teachers or parents or educators are thinking as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're completely spot on with that. When I sit back and have conversations with our pupils or even with my own children, we make assumptions, and not all assumptions are correct, you know, and just taking that time to listen to those children, allowing us to think about what it is that they are valuing out of what we're delivering and what they're gaining from it, is so, it's such an amazing teaching tool for us. So I often always say that I learn more as a teacher from my students than I sometimes think I actually teach them. If we take that time to allow them to have a say in their learning, I think their learning becomes so much more thorough, so much more rich.
Yeah, I would support that and say that I've seen some really nice pieces of evidence of how that's happening within schools. For me, it feels like the child-centered thought that we're talking about education is coming at it from two perspectives, perhaps. We've got this safety safeguarding part to ensuring a child is well-being is good, but equally whether they're sort of happy and content and the learning suits them so they can thrive. And I'm seeing evidence of both of those being supported in schools in a really child-centric way, just from some of the visits I've had with schools. So for example, my children's school have a tracking system. They call it AS tracking, but essentially it's a deep well-being tracking system. They ask the children from age 8 up to 11 to complete a questionnaire, an online questionnaire that then asks them sort of really specific questions about how they feel at school, about how they feel in the playground, in the classroom, amongst their friends. And the way that the questions are couched means that they can get a really accurate picture of how a child is really feeling inside, rather than perhaps how they present to teachers, which can obviously be quite different. And I think that must be such a useful tool to get to the bottom of a child's mental well-being and see if there are any warning signs that they need to be actioned. So I've seen that type of development of using an online tool, which is fantastic. And equally, in another school I've been to, again, they use another form of questionnaire, which asks about well-being and things, but it also dives more into how a children feels about their learning within the classroom. Off the back of that, they have this specialised, individualised lesson every day, which they put children into specific groups for that will help them with any areas of difficulty. So if a girl perhaps says, I find maths really intimidating because I can never answer the questions very quickly and I feel nervous about it, they put those girls into a sort of booster session. So they pre-learn before the class. And it's just really clever ways of trying to deep dive via online questionnaires and things to then support the school to ensure they're being as efficient and effective at looking after these children.
Because it's not always easy, is it, to find out what children are feeling and thinking? And it's well known in surveys, particularly the younger the children are, children will often tell adults what they think they want the adults to know. So finding out what the real feelings are can take some uncovering. And so you've got systems like that. And I think you've also got things like zones of regulation, which sound quite similar, which we use in our setting as well. And Ramita, I'm sure you have, you know, of others and have come across other ways in which we can find out more about how children are feeling so that we can then work out how best to help them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very well-known fact, but particularly as you hit young adolescent and adolescents, as generally those children start to lose a nuance between what they're feeling and what they might be feeling 1 minute can vary quite quickly to what they're feeling by the end of the day. So you never really maybe get a full picture if they're genuinely feeling something like fear around maths and intimidation, which is probably not a short-lived experience. It's probably something they genuinely feel quite, you know, it's a very valid feeling. However, I think there are studies to show that middle-aged kids, the middle years, as we call them in North America, they lose perspective on being able to name feelings and then don't understand how they can actually process or deal with those emotions if we haven't actually taught them how to do that. So I do spend a whole sort of one of my big areas of work with young people is around emotional intelligence and EQ and learning about our emotions, which I think is a difficult thing for us, even as adults, sometimes to know what it is that we're feeling and how to express that to somebody else. So for a child who's feeling a bit overwhelmed may not know the difference between I feel stressed versus I feel depressed or I feel, you know, lonely, that kind of thing.
That's probably a good moment to ask you, Ramita, a little bit more about what you do and how your work helps, specifically girls, how you try and help them navigate this complicated journey through one's emotions and how to handle them.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a sort of a culmination of things. I've drawn on three big areas around my experience as a teacher and educator, in working in various schools, independent sectors, single-sex schools, mixed schools, and then obviously being brought up in Canada, which might have a slightly different slant on the education system, because I specialized specifically there in middle years because they have middle schools in North America. So that was one element of it. And then learning how to navigate some of this learning as a parent, which I realized doesn't really work at all as a mature teacher, and trying to bring some of those skills. Everyone assumes because you're a teacher, you might be really good at parenting. And actually, as I've learned firsthand, that is not the case. So having raised my own now 17 and 14 year old to this level and understanding the complications around my own peer group, my friendships and my sort of colleagues that have kids the same age, I think that's been a real source of interest and learning. And then obviously I was 13 when my mum passed away. So I think having gone through my teen years, not having or having quite a big setback to deal with, and then growing up in an Indian culture where emotions are not something that come easily to our family members or are culturally is something that we have as a coping skill that we can use to talk about, I realized in hindsight that I think had I had some of the tools I wish to embark on children now, maybe some of the things I went through as a teenager would have felt less tricky. And I think what I decided to do was look at what we're doing. I think we do a lot of things in education very, very well, but there was an increasing and quite alarming rate of drop in children's sort of self-esteem, confidence, and concern between when they graduate in England, what we call junior school, and then before they enter senior school. We set them up well to get into these senior schools and to probably do well on the academic side of it. But we're somehow, I feel, we're failing them in some respects of setting them up for success in other areas in senior school. And so my thought processes in setting up Elevate was to how do we elevate girls, particularly whose mental health in many respects suffers greatly, or at least in some respects of their development quicker than boys. So hence their sort of self-esteem drops in many studies far greater. And I guess because I was a teeny girl myself, and at that time when I set up this company 4 years ago, my daughter was just hitting teen years. So I think that's where my sort of, okay, let's go with this with girls came from. And also just thinking about what we were doing at that time, and I think we still are, for our physical well-being. So prevention became a massive thing and became almost the way to look at health. We started doing things like ice baths and eating well, going to bed early, joining the 5 a.m. club, having our probiotics, and you know, everything we could possibly do for longevity has become the mainstream chat. So, and I thought, gosh, we're doing this for our physical health, but we're not really doing this probably for our kids, you know, in their education systems. So what can we do preventatively to help children? I think there was a massive look at statistics where there's wait lists for reactive measures to look after children, you know, with therapy and counseling and all sorts of other great things that we've got in place. But we just didn't do anything beforehand to prevent this sort of state of crises that our girls were hitting in their teen years. So that is really what I do. And I do that by looking at five areas of development that I don't think traditional classroom settings at the moment in most schools are hitting, around resilience, empathy, EQ, kindness, and specifically confidence building with growth mindset.
Wow, it's just such important work that you do. It really is phenomenal. You've mentioned those five, as you call them, superpowers, which yeah. I adhere to. I think they're well chosen and definitely can make you feel more on top of the world if you can act upon them. For a practical perspective, how do you feel that those superpowers, those confidence, resilience, empathy, emotional intelligence and kindness could be better taught or better supported within the classroom so that we could have fewer people hitting crisis point?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I had a head teacher 2 years ago approach me about exactly this thing. And I sat down with a lot of the work that I'd done and some of the case studies I'd sort of thought about over the children I worked with this mentoring program. And I developed a scheme of work, really. So it sort of works like a PSHE curriculum might work, but making the lessons, if you are to do them, relevant. I think some of the things I heard from the children I was working with was that, this is not a criticism, I've been a teacher, I've worked in schools, I understand how time pressure can really play into children's, you know, learning. And sometimes these soft skills, as they're called, get left because the other skills around how learning how to multiply or do long division or learning about a great novel, that it can take more of a teacher's time. So I think making it incredibly important, and making sure that the kids understand that we're going to talk about cyberbullying, we're going to talk about internet safety, and we're not going to color in or make a poster. We're going to look at real events that happened. We're going to look at actual case studies of children that have gone through this. And suddenly, you, when you say this happened to a 7-year-old or 8-year-old girl I worked with last year, their attention for the thing becomes so much more present. They're there with you. You've got them, because you tell them that this is something that really happened, and this is how you could be affected by something similar, and this is why having empathy is really important, or making it human. So for me, I talk about my experiences of moving from Canada to London and not being understood when I mentioned things in Canadian, as my kids, my students used to call it then. And genuinely sharing the experiences I had with not maybe expressing myself clearly because of the language or the vocabulary I used was different to the ones that people in England had, and how that felt for me, what it was like for people not to show me empathy or to laugh when I said something with an A and not say tomato, and I used to say tomato, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And we can laugh about it, but throwing humor into it can really make a difference as well. But I think if children see that we as adults have similar hardship, or we have been through similar hardship, and we're not just telling you this because we think we know better, but genuinely because we've been through something similar, or we experience these experiences too, and we can help you with the tools that will allow your experiences when you face them to be slightly easier if we talk about it in a way that makes it super relatable.
You can't see because we're not on video, but I'm sort of hard nodding over here as I'm listening to what you're saying. And it occurs to me that also that works for adults too, because the more we are reminded to have empathy and relate to other people's experience, the more we sort of get a sense of who people are. We stop that sort of sense of them and us, which is, I think, a huge cause of a lot of friendship disputes, which is perhaps something that comes up quite a lot in sort of towards the end of primary, beginning of secondary. And going back to that child's eye lens of the sense of understanding just how important peers are to children, that when we're sort of talking through how they can build that empathy, knowing that for many children, their peers are far more important than the teacher in the classroom. So they're going to be far more drawn to what their peers are doing or not doing than what maybe the teacher is sort of saying or not saying. So that's something that I think for me is quite striking. Recently, I came across an OECD paper, which was about what does child empowerment mean today, which really seemed to fit what we're talking about. It identified three ways of viewing childhood. It talked about the first one as being the being child. So the child is an independent social actor with the capacity to actively shape their own childhood. They talked about the becoming child as an adult in the making, in other words, related to adults as parents and teachers who will guide them into adulthood. And the third category was the being child, or the sense of past tense, as a conduit for the translation of childhood to adults. So in that sense, that third one, that being child, is us as teachers, as parents, as educators, understanding our own childhood experiences and memories as a way to connect with and guide children of today, which, Ramita, I think is exactly what you were talking about, bringing your own understanding and your own experience into the conversation with children. And it leads on to the next question, which is, we talked about this a little bit, but perhaps we can go into a bit more detail. What are some ways in which schools can understand better what children do need?
Yeah, I think Isabel brought up some good ideas around the questionnaires and making them sort of periodic, so you've got data. I think sometimes, you know, schools get need data in order to see that there is a need, right? And that allows the whole support to come in when they see the facts and the numbers are there. And a lot of children are saying that they're feeling X, Y, Z. So that's for definitely a good way of bringing that in. But I also wonder if there are ways that we can allow children. So one of the other superpowers we talk about is resilience. For example, how can we create more resilience in young children? So I like the fact that we talked about empathy, but let's just focus on resilience, for example, in this one. What can schools do? Well, I think we have to try and create, and maybe parents at home as well, have to try and create as many opportunities as possible that we allow children to fail safely. And I use the word safely with real emphasis on that word safely, because I think what we're doing is, in some respects, we're allowing children to feel like everyone's a winner, we're all going to win at something, and then they go out into the real world and they don't make their basketball teams or their soccer teams or whatever they're playing, and suddenly they're like, well, I'm not a winner because I didn't make it, you know. And that's quite a hard lesson for young people to learn. So if we allow children to understand that there will be challenge, there will always challenge, and there's always challenges to overcome, and nor is progress ever going to be linear, you know, you start to make progress and then we have a little dip, and then we have make a bit of progress and we have a little dip, but there's always, whenever that dip comes, that you're always going to be provided with a safety net. If they feel that that they get high challenge and high support, we will give children a chance to build resilience in a much more effective way. I can't see it any other way. And I think this was actually something that people use with some of the youth football teams around the social theory, the theory of social learning, I think that's what it's called, around giving children environments that have, first of all, exposure to lots of different ecosystems, right? You don't want them to be in the same environment all the time, because as soon as that environment varies a little bit, your children feel out of depth. So exposure to as many different types of environments is extremely important. To take them out of, if you live in one area of London, take them to different parts of London. If you know, I don't mean you have to get on a plane and travel the world, but you just have to get out of your comfort zone. And as more we lean into that discomfort, the more we allow children to feel that this is totally normal. We go from here to B, and we sometimes do well in that situation, and sometimes we don't. And we take the areas that we haven't done so well, and we reflect on them, and we learn from them. And when we learn from those situations, we grow. And that's how we build resilience. So if the schools can do that, I think what we're doing a lot is I hate to use the word success, maybe redefining success and what success looks like for you as a child at the start of the school year. What is it? What would this year look for you? You know, if you ask your children in the beginning of a school year in September, what would success in this year for you look like? What do you think would make you successful this year? And really allowing them at that time to think. I don't even know if they know the answer to that. And I also think that most kids try and give you answers that they think they should give or that they've heard their parents give. So success this year for you will be like, you know, nailing that 11 plus, or, you know, success for you would be getting that lead in your year's play or whatever it might be. And we want them to give you, and going right back to our original conversation around child-centric learning, that will really define, and sort of the work that I do with SEN kids, especially those with any kind of additional learning language, sometimes their goals, their success is just want to read for half an hour by myself every day without feeling stuck because I struggle with dyslexia, you know, and that can really shape the way you feel, let them feel empowered.
Adding on to that, as a parent, I have definitely a child who's not diagnosed, but mildly neurodiverse, I would say. And we have some real challenges in terms of getting her to learn and do all sorts of different things at home. We have to have quite long conversations about the fact that life isn't always easy and that things are tough and that we have to learn how to navigate that. And that's a very open conversation that I have with my daughter to try and help her realize that you do have to try and build resilience in a way, and that life isn't always going to be a bed of roses, which actually for most six-year-olds, they seem to think it's going to be. And there is definitely a sense that life should just be sweet, fun, game, and pretty easy most of the time. That's what their expectation is. And it's starting to teach children, I think, from quite an early age, both from home and from school, that that's just not the case.
And there's obviously this whole situation. I think Yuval Harari came up with a book for kids around why life is not always fair. It's not always fair. You know, some kids have to work really hard to be able to play netball well, and other children have to work really hard to understand maths. And it's kind of the cards you've been given. But how do we love ourselves or who we are without feeling down and trodden by it? I think that's where when we compare, and then we get into the whole comparison cycle and everything else, which might lead us on to our conversation in social media and why that can, you know, really play a part in our children's self-worth and self-belief, or devices and technology and all that kind of area that's coming into, which I guess is the hardest part for parents of this generation to have empathy with their children, because they are the first to be exposed to all of this in addition to all the things we experienced. So they've got an added layer of a complexity, I think, in their childhood that we never had, and we probably don't understand.
No, and maybe we should move on to talk a little bit more about that because it is such a hot topic at the moment. Thankfully, from my perspective, I believe the tide is turning, thanks to Jonathan Haidt and the smartphone-free childhood movement, which is just doing fantastic things at grassroots level. But maybe it would be useful just to track back a second and remind everyone about, from your experience, which is great, your personal sort of views and feelings about the effect of technology on the teams that you've been working with.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So the anxious generation, for any of our listeners that may not have read or heard of Jonathan Haidt's work, is a great read on getting statistics on what devices are doing. I think the difficulty, we came out of a pandemic and we can look at that and the loneliness sort of that developed out of kids not being able to interact. But I think we've kind of come out of the pandemic and we've developed this sense of friendship that is peculiar to myself, because for me, when you see a friend, you're really hanging out in person with that friend. But genuinely, children feel connected to their mates and their peers through this online world, be it video games or snapping or messaging or DMing. They feel sharing memes and sharing jokes through devices is the way they feel validated and on the in jokes and on the latest trends. So it's taken me a long time to genuinely put myself in their shoes to understand what that must feel like if you're the only person who hasn't got a device or hasn't had access to this meme or hasn't seen the joke on whatever it's happening, and then you feel a bit excluded. So this whole idea around collective activism, which is wonderful, if we all get behind it and we try and show children the damages. I think the difference that I talk about with my children, because I come at it from a science background, is to literally look at the neurological connections that you are giving your brain or not giving your brain, and what you're telling your brain is a dopamine hit from being online or getting a like, is actually literally heading towards this word, which I don't use lightly, but addiction. And any kind of addiction, be it alcohol or drugs or social media or phones, is an addiction. And asking them to think about whether that's a healthy concept or what healthy thing for your brain to be exposed to. So that's really where my kind of teaching around that comes in when I work with teens and tweens. So I don't believe in it being a great thing, but I understand how it saved, and I'm going to put the word saved in air quotes, some of the girls I've worked with who swear that they were saved because they had their phones or their friends at their fingertips and then that they got these messages. But I've equally seen it on how much it's hurt so many children and how the wrong messages can get land in the wrong in not inboxes, sorry, that shows my age, but in the wrong chat, and how you can really give somebody a terrible sense of themselves if you feel that all these people are talking about you. And you create this literally this world and this narrative about how you feel you belong in this group or in your peer group if you have X number of friends within your social circle, and the social circle being this online social circle as opposed to the physical 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 friends you might have if before social media existed.
It goes back to, it makes me think of our very first episode that we ran, which was on gamification, where we talked about a lot of these things, the dopamine hits that you get when you play a game, and also how that's being brought into education in the classroom quite a lot. Devices are a fantastic thing. And it also makes me think of that idea of a double world, where you've got the world which I see when children are out playing in the playground, and they love playing and they love games. And there's this whole world which I probably don't see at all, which is that other side, the online world. We talk a lot about this digital world, but it's sort of plugging into some pretty basic evolutionary things like status and comparison, and also that sense of community, which is, I think, it can be a very good thing. But there's something worrying about it, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, the biggest danger is the misinformation. Right. And of course, there's the predator side and all of that. You know, there's all those
Yeah,
worries, of course.
which is a whole other conversation we could have. Yes.
So there's definitely that. But if I just park out an impressionable young mind listening to some lovely girl talk about skincare and why a 10 or 11-year-old might need all these ingredients in their skin creams and why they should be out at Sephora or at Space NK buying these very expensive creams that no 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old girl needs. Yeah, every tween girl I work with spends an hour doing her skin routine at night. It's absolutely mind-boggling how this has become, and all of it started and went viral on TikTok. People using dermatologist tested and, you know, all this stuff to explain you're going to look like a Hailey Bieber if you do this, and you're going to look like X, and you're going to have this glow, and you're going to have dewy skin. Like, even the vocabulary, dewy skin, like, why does a 9-year-old need to have even know what dewy skin look? You know, I listen to it and I think, wow, gosh, they have been influenced, which is what the influencer's job is to do. So if we're not careful, without us as parents knowing it, or carers or teachers knowing it, our children are being taught by other teachers, and their messages are landing in a much more powerful way than we will ever be able to compete with, if that makes sense. So that's the dangerous side of devices and having it unmonitored, and you know, all the other things that come with introducing a child to a whole new thing. I think I'm sure it was it maybe in that book that we're talking about the action generation, but in the 90s we didn't really worry. I think that was the thing, that kids played outside all the time. It was like the thing to do. So as you say, David, children love playing. There was some, you know, real nervousness around dangers outside and people feeling nervous about leaving their children out to play unsupervised. So more and more of that culture brings children inside, and we've kind of created this play at home so that you're safe. But now we're letting them play online with games, and we don't know what adverts are being targeted. We don't. So are they safe in this world that they are divulged in? Because we can't see it. You can't really see what your children are being exposed to, because we can't have eyes on them the whole time, and they can be scrolling into things that they shouldn't be really being exposed to. So that is worrying. And I think playing in the old sense and letting kids be bored is something we're not really encouraging much.
And the pandemic accelerated this, of course, in lots of ways. It also makes me think about how the division between what you do as a sort of teacher in school and what the school does and what parents and children do at home has been blurred a lot in the last 4 years, in the sense that, I mean, the next question I was going to ask was really about, we talk a lot about on this podcast about creating a culture, because that's so important to all the things we do in schools, creating a culture of that listens to children and supports them. But actually we're talking about a culture that works for schools, but which can also reach out to the world at home as well. How can we create a culture that supports children and listens to children and helps them overcome these challenges, both the newer ones and the older ones?
So I think it's interesting what you say about the lines being blurred between school and home. I definitely agree with you on that point. And I think a lot of parents feel, especially if you are in a sector where you're paying for your education, they feel we're putting a lot of money into the school. It's their job to look after this whole being of my child. And I get, especially as the kids get older, that kids respond better to teachers than they do parents. So if you tell them this is the rule, we have better chance of having them abide by these regulations or rules or whatever they might be. So I think that can get confusing, and obviously what one says, where everyone's moral compasses vary, every family is different in how they look at situations, and I think that you can't compare two families just like you can't compare two kids. However, I do worry that we are moving towards this world where we're giving increasingly more homework online, research is happening online, AI is supporting a lot of our teaching, children are being asked to get devices. And then we're telling these kids, get off your screens, get off your screens. And it's like, well, listen to the message they're getting. How is it possible that school's saying, parents, get your kids off screens, let them play more? And then they feel that, well, all their homework, the kids are telling parents, I can't because my homework's online. I've got to have my iPad. I've got to have a device. I've got to have a computer. And more children, as I've been told, yes, you can take certain settings and you can have parental control set up. But I don't know how many busy working parents sit there and monitor those things, because I know lots of children that have a Netflix corner in the bottom, their Google Doc on one side. So you talk about attention span, and they're kind of doing a little bit of Netflixing, a little bit of this, and then they've got their phone and they're pinging messages and DMing at the same time, all in the umbrella of I'm just doing my homework. And that can be really complicated, I think, for families and schools. So I think we have to have a clear sort of a set of expectations. We need to maybe have a time limit on how long we want this assignment to take. And we think we should deliver that to parents, and saying that the screens should be shut down, because whatever we've set them should not take longer than, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes. And after that, we draw a line on it and say our child was on the screen for 30 minutes and this is all they've completed. And then leave it to the teacher, perhaps, to see what they. I don't know. Is that a viable solution?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it's communication and finding ways to have intercommunication as well. So you're getting feedback from parents. There's got to be that channel. I mean, we can do it in lots of different ways. Obviously, we can do it online, but also just having a homework diary where a parent writes something in can be a really nice way of that communication. We get a lot of emails in the independent sector from parents, and there's a sort of often a toing and froing of responses and meetings and things like that, but however we do it, yes, I think it's a three-way communication, right, between parents, the children, and the teachers. And I say parents, guardians, where you're getting feedback on that. And that's got to be some way towards creating a culture where everyone understands what the expectations are, and everyone understands that sometimes those expectations don't meet with reality. I mean, as an English teacher, I have this sort of visual idea of a child's, because I don't have children, of a child's home life, where there's this sort of almost empty room where they're sitting and doing their homework. And it's, you'll probably laugh at this, they quietly are getting on with it with no distractions. But of course, that's not what's happening.
I found it very interesting, having been a teacher for a long time without children and now having children, and realising what goes on at home, particularly to do with homework, but just generally with being a parent. And I spend a long time speaking to my friends about how isolated it can feel being a parent in terms of what other people are doing and what the expectation is. Screens or watching TV is a perfect example of one aspect of parenting that's hugely important. You know, it's quite difficult to kind of work through and create rules, which is what most parents spend a lot of time doing, is making rules to kind of, you know, suit their needs. And it is definitely, I think, one of the things that would be useful for schools to do is have, again, these practical workshops for parents, which is giving an idea or a hint of what would be considered sensible to do at home, or opening it up for debate and discussion to find out what other people are doing and finding out what a middle ground is, trying to figure out your way through it and be reasonable with it all.
And increasingly schools are a center of community in a world where we are less religious, and therefore the place that maybe a religious worship would take in a center of a community is replaced often by schools. There being very few other places where lots of different people in the community come together. And we're talking not just parents and children, but also you've got grandparents often as well, engaging with pickups and all sorts of school things. There is an opportunity as well as a difficulty there to shape a culture on a community level, not just when the gates of the school kind of close, and then what happens behind the school and then what happens at home are different. But increasingly schools are being asked to, and I'm thinking particularly of schools in areas of low income, where they are providing not just obviously breakfast and lunch, but many other things as well. Financially, schools are just taking the brunt of the cost of living crisis. And so having a culture where child's needs are at the forefront, whether that's material needs or emotional, mental needs, is definitely, I think, the future of schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a lot of C words that I think are, and we've hit on a couple of them. I think you said communication, David, and I think Isabel, you mentioned community as well. Consistency and clarity are really important too, right? Mm-hmm. That we can't change our minds from year to year either. I think sometimes schools bring in a policy, then they take away, then they're putting a new policy. We're notorious for that, I think. And I think parents struggle too. They need consistency as well. And I think kids, if they are at the end of this world where like you're 1 minute you're telling me this, the next minute you're telling me this, they just can't process any of that. And they need, in order to thrive, real clear boundaries, and they need to be able to communicate with people that they know are going to be consistent with them.
I agree. I think that's fantastic. Moving on a little bit, if teachers and parents want to find out more about the area which we've been talking about, Ramita, do you have any good books, podcasts, or ideas about how people can get more information other than Elevate?
I read up with Professor Mark Brackett. He comes from Yale University, and he's done something called he's written a book called Permission to Feel, which he has expanded to middle-aged adolescent kids. And I think a lot of his RULER program has been incorporated into lots of schools across the state of New York, which I think is a fantastic way to help children understand and name their feelings. There's a Canadian writer, gotta get a plug in for Canadians, David, sorry, called Michael Unger, who talks about resilience, and his book is called I Still Love You. There is Untangled, if you're looking specifically for girls, which I use a lot, that Dr. Lisa Damore, who's written quite a few books, and she's just been hugely involved in this famous film that's been released, Inside Out 2. Talking all about emotions and the children getting into puberty and adolescence. So she's great to listen. She's got a podcast as well, actually. I think it's called Ask Lisa. And then there's Dr. Becky Kennedy, who covers all ranges of children and both sexes. And her book, Good Inside, I think is a really great place to look for some ideas on that. And then there's they're not specifically for children, but I think it applies so much to children, this book called Big Feelings by the illustrators Liz Foslian and Molly West Duffy. I don't know if you've seen some of their sort of picture, like they take really big concepts that are really hard to grasp but really simplify them into really nice pictures, cartoons and drawings that I think make anyone who's a visual learner might look at that and go, oh yeah, That makes total sense to me. That's exactly how I feel. And that's a really nice way to share and read it one page a day with your kid. I think is a really nice way of showing them that we can all feel overwhelmed and our brain can feel like a big snowball of mess. So what you're feeling is a little bit maybe anxious because of these overwhelming feelings and things like that. So that's a really nice way to talk to children about that. And of course, I love Alan de Botton, and I think everything he says in the School of Life is probably no surprise to many educators, but I think the School of Life is a really good way to think about education.
And Elevate podcast as well, which you've had on hold for a year. Have you got plans to start that up again?
I'm in conversations with a few people, so that might be coming again. But and I do have a catalogue of about 70 odd or 75 episodes.
You have a lot, yes. Yeah, I'll keep working my way through it, but it'll take me a while because there is a lot there. So anyone who's looking out for just listening to more of Ramita and her wonderful guests that she get on should definitely look at Elevate. Brilliant.
There's lots in there. There's things on friendships. I know Elizabeth Day, very well-known journalist and podcaster. She wrote a book on friendships, which I love, the Friendaholics thing. And friendships in tween years, and especially girls, can be a real massive issue, as we sort of touched on earlier. So I've done some work and talked to lots of people about how we break down some of the themes that she talks about. And teens have ghosting and losing and all that kind of stuff. But bringing it down to children's level as well, because sometimes moving schools, losing friends, changing, all that kind of stuff can be very challenging. So we have a lot of conversations on that podcast that are specifically are looking at navigating change with children.
Brilliant. There's a lot to follow up. And what we'll do is we'll put this on the show notes for this episode so that people can hopefully just click a link and find out a bit more about some of those things. We are probably coming towards the end, but I like to finish off with the question of what we're really excited about in education at the moment, which may be one of the books you've talked about. But I'm going to start off going to Isabel and ask you what you are excited about in education at the moment. What is firing you up?
It's probably what we've already talked about. And for me, it's, I suppose, linked to education, but to do with parenting. And it is the welcome realization that smartphones and technology, their use needs to be changed by the early, middle school tween generation. And I'm just so thrilled it's come to light now that the effects of those on children, and that I believe things will really change for the better in the next 5 to 10 years. So that for me is great. From an educational perspective, obviously, schools are really starting to drive forward to get them out of the schools. And I think hopefully it will be followed by parents as well. So that's what's really getting me going these days.
Sounds great. And Ramita, if you were going to pick one thing that was really exciting you, what is it?
I'm quite excited by the great new STEM projects kids are taking and embarking on, and the sort of stereotypes around STEM being not cool or sort of pigeonholing the type of kid that might like to code. And I'm loving getting girls into coding and seeing the excitement around possibly AI helping that world. So using technology for good rather than bad, but I love it. I love it when, I spoke to a tween today who I asked what their summer holiday was about. She said, I spent time going to a camp and I learned to develop an app for parents that might not know, and kids, what is the right first aid remedy to use when you're hit an emergency. I was just like, go you. So, you know, this stuff is just brilliant for me. I think seeing that and that spark of excitement for a child and then going, kind of, how do I get this app, you know, for as an adult, makes me feel like filled with hope and excitement for children's future and education.
And how about you, David? What's getting you going as we start September 2024, new academic year?
Yeah,
I mean, I love teaching literature, and I'm teaching Little Women the second time, and that's a really exciting thing. And then I think I'm looking forward to National Poetry Day. We've got a poet coming in called Astra Papakristodoulou, who's a visual poet, and she does things like Jenga poetry, where you pull out a block and then the poem is slightly different as you pull out more blocks until, of course, eventually the ending is a collapse of the poem. So I'm excited by the ways in which we can keep getting children, you know, into reading and writing and just generally loving literature.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Isabel, and thank you, Ramita. And you can find out lots more about Ramita's work on her podcast and on her website, Elevate RA. Isabel, thank you so much for being our co-presenter today in the absence of Ross and Aaron. It's just a pleasure to speak to you both.
Oh, I'm so glad that Ross was up a mountain, so I got the opportunity to be with you guys. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm sorry I missed you, Ross, but it was a real pleasure to meet you, Isabel, and so grateful, David, that you have this wonderful platform for all of us to get together and have these important conversations.
You've been listening to The Rest is Education. Please follow us on LinkedIn and keep emailing us with your questions and comments, anything you want to discuss more at therestiseducation.com.